This is Tom on Tuesday, June 2nd, reading Bloomberg.com and Bloomberg Business Week. Stocks stall as traders weigh peace deal prospects. Market wrap. A rally in U.S. stocks is pausing after the artificial intelligence trade fueled the S&P 500's longest winning streak in more than a year, with investors gauging prospects for an end to the war in the Middle East. Futures for the U.S. benchmark slipped 0.1% after an eight-day run of gains. Technology shares gave European and Asian stocks a fresh boost. Marvell Technology, Inc. soared 19% in U.S. pre-market trading after NVIDIA Corp's Jensen Huang said the chipmaker could be the next trillion-dollar company. Brent eased after its biggest gain in about a month, falling 1.2% to below $94 a barrel. President Donald Trump is still optimistic the U.S. can reach an interim peace agreement with Iran over the next week, after the Islamic Republic threatened to suspend talks because of Israel's escalating attacks in Lebanon. Traders are juggling unprecedented euphoria around the economic potential of AI and a war that has brought about a historic disruption in oil markets. Uncertainty about how close a deal may be means investors must consider that crude prices could retreat dramatically or scale to the highest level in years. In the latest example of the vast amounts of capital being pumped into AI infrastructure, Alphabet Inc. said it is raising $80 billion through equity offerings. The announcement came hours after Anthropic PBC filed draft paperwork for a possible blockbuster initial public offering. We may be approaching the point where optimism around the long-term positive impact of the AI build-out is going to crash against a wall of higher yields, higher inflation, and lower growth, said Stephen Kemper, chief investment strategist at BNP Paribas Wealth Management. In bond markets, treasuries found some relief, with a 10-year yield falling 2 basis points to 4.43%. The dollar edged lower, while Bitcoin dropped below $70,000 for the first time in 2 months. Treasuries have sold off in recent weeks as investors increasingly bet the Federal Reserve may need to keep rates higher for longer to contain the biggest inflation surge since 2023. The move has also raised questions about whether the mounting U.S. debt burden and AI financing demands are pushing up yields. U.S. data, such as the ISM manufacturing print we just had, still keeps the Fed inflation debate alive and limits the scope for a dovish rates repricing, especially if oil remains volatile, said Alessandro Gabalone, fixed income analyst at Bank Degroof Petercam. Tuesday's figures on U.S. job openings will likely add to the series of favorable labor market data releases for April. High-frequency data suggests total openings inched up, particularly in the second half of the month, according to Bloomberg Economics. Japan's 10-year yield dropped 10 basis points after an auction drew firm demand. The yen was steady around 159.70 per dollar, as Japanese Finance Minister Satsuki Katayama said authorities were ready to take steps as needed in the foreign exchange market. Software stocks have caught a bid in recent days after lagging technology peers for months. Some investors say the group could help extend the tech rally as traders become more selective about AI winners and losers. We don't see a bubble at the moment in the tech sector as the earnings season has vindicated the market price action, said Roland Kaloyan, head of European equity strategy at Societe Generale SA. We see the current trading levels of software and cybersecurity sectors as attractive entry points in terms of valuation. Global investors are reaching an overall inflection point for AI sentiment with the upcoming SpaceX IPO. The giant sale is based on valuation projections, which have rarely been seen before. Of course, everything may not run smoothly, and the AI theme will be enhanced. But if not, traders will circle back looking for reasons to trim exposure. In the corporate news, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise Company soared 24% in U.S. pre-market trading on massive AI-fueled demand for its servers and networking equipment. SK Hynix Inc. plans to double its memory chip wafer capacity over the coming half decade, a major expansion that should help ease a global shortage of an essential component of AI. Abivax SA shares plunged after cancer cases in a crucial clinical trial for an experimental bowel disease drug threw the French biotech's future into question. Alphabet Inc. unveiled plans to raise $80 billion through equity offerings, including an investment deal with Berkshire Hathaway Inc., highlighting the scale of spending tied to the race to build AI infrastructure. SpaceX wants a fee cut from IPO bankers, targeting $500 million windfall. Elon Musk's SpaceX is negotiating to pay razor-thin fees to Wall Street for firms handling its IPO, but banks are still likely to rake in about $500 million from the record-setting market debut. Musk's space and artificial intelligence conglomerate is negotiating to pay less than 0.75% for the $75 billion it aims to drum up in an initial public offering this month, according to people with knowledge of the matter. Even at that low spread, it will likely amount to one of the biggest fee events ever for Wall Street firms that arrange public listings. The lead banks, Goldman Sachs Group Inc. and Morgan Stanley, are positioned to take in a bigger share of the fee pool than the other 21 brokers involved. The figures represent the base fee being charged to SpaceX and don't factor in other discretionary incentives, the people said, asking not to be identified discussing non-public information. Investment banks typically charge 4% to 7% on IPOs, which raise less than $1 billion on average. That fee percentage drops sharply for giant debuts when banks corral investors to hand over billions of dollars at once. But even in those cases, it's usually more than 1%. The slim margin that banks are offering Musk has implications for a slate of blockbuster IPOs in the works for this year. That could force investors and analysts to temper expectations for Wall Street's earnings as OpenAI and Anthropic PBC also lay the groundwork to tap equity markets in the months ahead. One of the lowest spreads ever charged for a mega IPO was when banks negotiated a 0.75% fee with the U.S. government for General Motors Company in 2010. Back then, Wall Street was desperate to rebuild public sentiment after taking taxpayer-funded bailouts in the financial crisis. There was also concern about a backlash if they made a juicy profit. At the time, the U.S. government owned a majority of the automaker after saving that industry, too. Chinese internet giant Alibaba Group Holding Limited, which raised $25 billion in its 2014 IPO, paid about $300 million to underwriters, including performance fees. Even Saudi Aramco, famously tight-fisted on handing fees to banks, was expected to pay over 1% when it was pursuing an international listing. That pool was cut sharply after Saudi Arabia sidelined global banks advising on Aramco's IPO and pared it back to a mainly domestic affair. SpaceX is targeting a valuation of about $1.8 trillion, Bloomberg previously reported. At that size, a $75 billion fundraising would easily eclipse the previous IPO record. The company will reserve up to 5% of shares from the offering for certain employees and friends and families of its executive officers, according to a filing Monday. Meanwhile, Anthropic confidently submitted draft paperwork for a public listing in a bid to leapfrog longtime rival OpenAI in the race to stock market this year. and Google parent Alphabet Inc. says it's raising $80 billion through a package of equity offerings. Altogether, the massive sales may test how much Wall Street bankers can raise so quickly from the public. Marvel soars after NVIDIA chief's $1 trillion stock call. Marvell Technology, Inc. shares surged in early trading Tuesday after NVIDIA Corp's Jensen Huang predicted the semiconductor and networking company will be the next business to hit a $1 trillion valuation, more than five times its current capitalization. Marvell's valuation will soar now that the age of useful AI has arrived, Huang, the chief executive officer of the largest publicly traded company, said Tuesday at Computex trade show in Taipei, alongside Marvel CEO Matt Murphy. NVIDIA has something to gain in saying so. The chip giant took a $2 billion stake in Marvel 3 months ago as part of a broader partnership. Marvel shares were up 23% at $270 in pre-market trading in New York on Tuesday. The stock has gained 158% this year, giving the Santa Clara, California-based company a market value of $192 billion. If the rally holds when the market opens, the firm will notch the biggest intraday jump since March. Surging demand for artificial intelligence and the data centers needed to train and run models is boosting the chip industry. The biggest tech companies, such as Amazon.com, Inc., Alphabet, Inc., and Microsoft Corp., have pledged to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to build data center capacity and invest in AI. Demand for products like OpenAI's ChatGPT and Anthropic PBC's Claude have created a gold rush to capture market share for the infrastructure supporting the new technology. Marvell is among several semiconductor companies enjoying gains this week from the renewed euphoria around the AI boom. Memory chip maker SK Hynix Inc. plans to double memory chip production capacity to ease a supply crunch. ST Microelectronics NV nearly doubled its forecast for revenue from data centers in 2026 and said the sales could double again next year. Chip designer Arm Holdings PLC expects to hit a target of $15 billion in sales for semiconductors earlier than anticipated because of demand from the AI boom, CEO Rene Haas said. NVIDIA has ridden the AI wave better than any other company, becoming the primary supplier of the GPU chips used for AI. Its shares have gained more than 1,400% since 2023, valuing the company at $5.4 trillion. Around about 15 companies had market values exceeding $1 trillion as of Monday, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. All of them, with the exception of Saudi Arabian Oil Company, drug maker Eli Lilly and Company, and Berkshire Hathaway, are tech companies. America's corporate protector. 4 days into his tenure as acting head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Russell Vought got an email from an old colleague. "Hey, Russ, hope all is going well amidst the bureaucracy ass-kicking," it began. Vought, who was leading President Donald Trump's Office of Management and Budget, as well as the CFPB, had already made headlines for saying he wanted to put federal workers in trauma. He began his CFPB tenure by choking off the agency's funding, shutting its headquarters, and halting its work. But this email wasn't just about well wishes. The sender, Dennis Potter, had worked with Vought on Capitol Hill in the early 2000s. Now a lobbyist at the law firm Holland & Knight, he wanted to know whether Vought could help Toyota Motor Corp's financing arm. It had signed a settlement with the CFPB in 2023, and now it wanted out. Toyota had paid a $12 million fine and agreed to make refunds totaling $48 million to thousands of customers who complained that the company made it unreasonably hard to cancel unwanted maintenance and insurance plans. They said salesmen had duped them into buying the products, which could add as much as $2,500 to their car purchase. When people called to get out of the contracts, however, the CFPB alleged they were directed to a retention hotline and had to ask three times to cancel before being told they could only do so in writing. In the email, Potter said the CFPB had bullied Toyota, the world's largest automaker, into signing the settlement. Potter and Toyota didn't respond to questions seeking additional context about the mails or how the company was bullied. A spokesperson for Holland & Knight, who isn't registered to represent the carmaker, said the firm follows the highest standards of ethics and professionalism in all of its engagements. 3 months later, Toyota got off the hook. Vought ended the settlement early, saving the company roughly $40 million in customer refunds. It was one of more than three dozen investigations, settlements, and lawsuits that the CFPB abandoned over the past 15 months, public records show. In all, the agency's decisions meant business could pocket millions they'd already agreed to refund to consumers and avoid costly monitoring and compliance. Companies also may have escaped penalties from ongoing lawsuits that alleged billions of dollars in consumer harm. In a statement, Rachel Colley, a spokesperson for CFPB, said Vought and his team are responding to overreach by Rohit Chopra, the agency's director under former President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. Under Chopra's leadership, the CFPB developed a more expansive view of its authority as it adapted to non-banks and technology companies playing larger roles in consumer finance. The Biden-Harris-Chopper regime was weaponized against political enemies and disfavored industries and used novel legal theories and secret justifications to ruin lives and businesses, Colley said. We are fixing that, bringing the agency back to operating within statute and away from breaking the law and making cases right to help small businesses and Americans who were victims of this thuggery. During his tenure, Chopper delivered $10 billion for consumers when companies broke the law, said Allison Price, a spokesperson for the former director. Vought has done nothing to make life better or more affordable for Americans, she added. And in fact, it appears that the Trump administration has been enriching corporate donors at the expense of working families. Last October, during an appearance on the Charlie Kirk Show, Vought explained his approach to CFPB as a victory for the little guy. All they want to do is weaponize the tools of financial laws against basically mom-and-pop lenders and other small financial institutions, he said. Yet a review of the enforcement actions that Vought and his team scuttled shows that most of them involve big businesses, like Toyota. At least two-thirds of the canceled payments or lawsuits were against firms that, along with any parent companies, had more than $500 million in annual revenue. About a third implicated businesses in the S&P 500, including Apple Inc., J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, and Walmart Inc. While federal judges have stymied Vought's attempts to starve the CFPB of funding and fire nearly all of its staff, his ability to cancel settlements and overrule the Bureau's enforcement arm has gone largely unchecked because the agency's director has wide latitude over that domain. To report this story, Bloomberg News reporter spoke with 18 current and former CFPB lawyers who had direct knowledge of its casework. Most of them requested anonymity to discuss confidential matters. These people, along with two dozen other government officials, lobbyists, attorneys, and consumer advocates, provided a detailed look into inside how the Trump administration intervened on behalf of businesses to the detriment of consumers. Some of the businesses that got relief had links to the administration or to prominent people in the president's orbit. A penalty imposed on a fintech company backed by the venture capital firm of Mark Andreessen, a Trump mega donor, was reduced by 98%. Brad Bondi, the brother of former Attorney General Pam Bondi, saw a lawsuit against one of his clients dismissed. An investigation into another business was closed after Donald Trump Jr. joined the parent company's board. The scrutiny has hobbled the agency's ability to bring new cases and uphold more than a dozen consumer protection laws Congress entrusted it to enforce, current and former officials said. The CFPB said it closed about 40% of its open investigations last year, according to a tally the Bureau published on its website last week after Bloomberg asked about its enforcement record. About half, or more than 100, of the CFPB's enforcement staff have left, according to a recent court filing. Since Vought took over in February 2025, the Bureau has announced just one enforcement action. It just feels like nihilism, said David Silberman, who worked at the agency from its inception until 2020, rising to acting deputy director during Trump's first term. The current administration is simply hostile to government, to this agency, and to the people who work there. One of the first signs that Trump intended to shake things up at CFPB came on Friday, February 7, 2025. That afternoon, Elon Musk, who at the time was deploying his Department of Government Efficiency across Washington, posted to his more than 200 million followers on X, CFPB RIP. He also added a tombstone emoji. That evening, Trump appointed Vought as the CFPB's acting director. Vought soon detailed several deputies from the budget office to help him review and overhaul the agency's enforcement work. One was Dan Bishop, a former Republican congressman, who'd get confirmed as Vought's deputy director at OMB. Years earlier, as the state lawmaker, Bishop authored North Carolina's bathroom bill, requiring transgender people to use public restrooms matching their birth sex. Another key person detailed to the CFPB was Mark Poletta, who became the agency's chief legal officer and was promoted last week to deputy director. A veteran of past Republican administrations, Poletta had shepherded Clarence Thomas through his controversial 1991 Senate confirmation hearings, which led to his appointment to the Supreme Court. Two former Thomas clerks, Daniel Shapiro and Victoria Dorfman, were also recruited to help. Within days, this team had begun to make its mark. Facing a federal court deadline in late February 2025, Poletta and Shapiro submitted paperwork to dismiss the agency's enforcement case against Solo Funds, Inc., a fintech company that arranges small-dollar loans. In its lawsuit, the CFPB alleged that Solo advertised no-interest loans, but borrowers paid tips in more than 99% of the transactions, charges that could push financing costs above limits set by state laws. The company disputed the CFPB's allegations in court filings, saying its advertising was not deceptive. Solo did not respond to requests for comment from Bloomberg, but at the time of the dismissal, it issued a statement noting that Vought expressed shock that the CFPB ignored the company's benefits to consumers. Colley, a CFPB spokesperson, said the lawsuit was an attempt to drive an African-American-owned company out of business and stop low-income Americans from getting cash to pay for things like unexpected medical bills. Poletta and Shapiro sought the dismissal with prejudice, a legal maneuver that would bar the regulators from bringing any similar action against Solo in the future. The CFPB had never sought that sort of dismissal previously because it would have tied the agency's hands, according to people familiar with the matter. Vought and his team would go on to dismiss or withdraw from another 19 lawsuits, 16 of them with prejudice, a tactic one former CFPB attorney likened to burning the crops on the way out of town. Kaylee Long, a 34-year-old truck driver in East St. Louis, Illinois, opened an account with Navy Federal Credit Union in 2023 after hearing its ubiquitous ads about empowering military families. His grandfather had served in the Air Force, making Long eligible to join the credit union. He figured Navy Federal, with more than $200 billion in assets, could help him improve his finances and eventually buy a house. But within a year, he said he had racked up more than $200 in overdraft fees after what he described as an erroneous charge that Navy Federal would not reverse. "This devastated me," he said. "I couldn't pay for gas, couldn't pay my bills." Frustrated, he said he left the credit union in 2025. Trump taps Pulte as acting director of national intelligence. President Donald Trump said he is tapping Bill Pulte, the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, as the acting director of national intelligence. Trump posted on social media Tuesday that Pulte would also remain in his role as FHFA director and as chairman of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. "The selection of Pulte is unusual. The housing chief lacks military and intelligence community experience, yet Pulte is a loyal ally of Trump's." Tulsi Gabbard has announced that she would step down from her role as National of Intelligence this month. In View, Richard E. Feinberg outlines the grand bargain that could turn around Cuba's economy. Cuba is in truly dire straits. The Caribbean island is being crushed between two powerful opposing forces. A Trump administration intent on forcing regime change with a punishing oil blockade and a defiant Cuban Communist Party wedded to an anachronistic state-led model and a deep distrust of the revolution's historic enemy. This is an unsustainable degree of stress for an economy made brittle after decades of being drained of two essential components: people and capital. Since 2019, at least 1.5 million Cubans, 15% of the population, have abandoned their homeland, fleeing a repressive bureaucracy to seek a better life abroad. This exodus, on top of a low fertility rate, has left behind an aging populace. About a quarter of Cubans are older than 60, one of the highest shares in Latin America. The country also suffers from a depleted capital stock. Rusting farm tractors and other machinery are long past their productive lives. The electrical grid is close to collapse, a situation hastened by recent fuel shortages, and other infrastructure, including ports, airports, and railroads, is visibly deteriorated. All this is largely the legacy of decades of underinvestment by the leadership. Annual outlays amount to just 10% of the country's gross domestic product, less than half the Latin American average. After the breakup of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, a source critical of economic aid, Cuba's authorities cautiously and haltingly allowed small-scale private enterprises. During a brief thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations, initiated by President Barack Obama in 2014, aspiring young Cubans opened classy restaurants, software design studios, and other startups. If these gradual reforms had been allowed to mature, the authorities might have managed to steer the economy to a soft landing. This was the optimistic vision I conjured in my 2016 book, Open for Business: Building the New Cuban Economy. But the reimposition of paralyzing sanctions during President Donald Trump's first administration turned hope into despair. The window for piecemeal measures has closed shut. In 2026, desperate times call for urgent, decisive leaps forward. With preliminary meetings between Havana and Washington underway, this is a good time to ponder what bold measures might restore hope and keep restless young talent from seeking opportunities abroad. What must be done to correct the island's chronic, debilitating deficit of investment capital? And most immediately, what initiatives could alleviate the deepening humanitarian crisis? A vital first step would be the appointment of a new economic team, as U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has insisted. President Miguel Díaz-Canel's mostly mediocre, listless economic cabinet should be replaced by capable, energetic Cuban technocrats from on and off the island, perhaps bolstered by experienced international advisors. But this fresh team can succeed only if it's empowered to radically restructure the bankrupt Cuban state. To earn credibility and gain momentum, any comprehensive reform package would have to be endorsed by the U.S. in a constructive grand bargain, detailed and transparent, that promises economic renewal in Cuba while advancing American interests, such as controlling migration and combating trafficking of illicit narcotics. Such a far-reaching deal would require the U.S. to definitely lift the 64-year-old embargo. Investors won't show up if they fear crippling sanctions could be reimposed anytime at the whim of politicians in Washington. Two other critical steps toward unlocking investment would be the passage of domestic legislation that unequivocally secures property rights and agreement between the two countries on trustworthy international mechanisms for settling investor disputes. Next, the bloated, inefficient Cuban state must be radically streamlined, a process that would involve auctioning off government-owned enterprises. Reviving tourism can jumpstart a recovery, but deep reforms will be needed to spur investment in other promising sectors, including renewable energy, export-oriented agriculture, and light manufacturing. Prompt settlement of outstanding property claims dating from the expropriations of the 1960s would be one way for Washington and Havana to engineer what economists call a positive confidence shock. Here, the groundwork has already been laid. The U.S. Foreign Claims Settlement Commission has certified almost 6,000 claims valued at $1.9 billion, excluding any interest. Certified claimants would be compensated through a U.S.-administered trust fund by means of debt for equity swaps or, in exceptional circumstances, property restitution. To be clear, though, it's not the place of the U.S. government to advocate for Cubans or Cuban Americans who were not American citizens at the time they lost their property. Expelling thousands of families living in properties expropriated from other Cubans would be a recipe for civil disorder, potentially threatening the entire reform project. The process of downsizing the sprawling state apparatus could begin with tourism. Cuba lists 86 nominally five-star hotels with 43,000 rooms, most owned by three major state-owned enterprises. Gaviota, a unit of GAESA, a giant holding company of the armed forces. Cubanacan and Grand Caribe, both arms of the Ministry of Tourism. Some could be sold outright and rebranded, while others might be managed as joint ventures. Proceeds from the sale of iconic properties in need of extensive repairs, such as the Hotel Nacional Habana Libre, formerly a Hilton, and the Havana Riviera, built by U.S. mobster Mayor Linsky, might be earmarked to pay compensation to certified claimants. The decrepit national electric grid would require massive investment in power generation, more than $6 billion by some estimates, as well as transmission and distribution. The island has ample potential for solar and wind, and its sugarcane industry could support production of biofuels. But to attract foreign capital, the power sector's regulatory framework must be overhauled, perhaps with technical assistance from the international development agencies. While a revival in tourism may be sufficient to rekindle growth, Cuba's new economic stewards will need to quickly draft blueprints for economic diversification at the sectoral and regional levels to consolidate the recovery. Cuba imports more than half the food it consumes, much of it from the U.S. Cuban-American families are itching to apply modern technologies to revive the once grand sugar and rum industries and bring back mass production of premium cigars. Recapitalized farms could ship fresh tropical fruits and vegetables to hungry markets in the U.S., but none of this can happen unless outmoded systems of land tenure and other agricultural regulations are completely revamped. A remodeled Cuba could compete with Mexico, Costa Rica, and the Dominican Republic and other neighbors in producing apparel, medical devices, electronic components, and auto parts, integrating its factories into the supply chains of U.S.-based multinationals. The 10-year-old Mariel Special Development Zone is prime for such investments. The U.S. naval base in Guantanamo, outdated as a strategic asset, might be repurposed as a second production hub. Last but not least, Cuba's private sector, about 12,000 authorized small businesses, plus 500,000 micro enterprises, must finally be unfettered from multiple restrictions in design to keep them from challenging state monopolies. Ambitious Cuban entrepreneurs should be able to do business seamlessly with state enterprises and foreign-owned firms, and they should be allowed to court diaspora capital, which could become an important contributor to any renaissance. In this bilateral bargain, we can envision two contrasting models, one welcoming investors from around the world, or one privileging U.S. firms such as some in the Trump administration might prefer. In tourism, for example, the second route might call for squeezing out current hotel operators such as the Spanish Change, Iberostar, and Melia, and Germany's Kempinski. Similarly, is the U.S. government prepared to provide large-scale humanitarian relief, to restock the empty cells and build popular support for a transition? Or will the U.S. share the financial burden with other nations? Should Cuba be admitted to the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and Inter-American Development Bank with their vast technical expertise and lending capacities, where the U.S. is the largest but not the only shareholder? Another strategic choice whether to accept a continuing Chinese commercial presence on the island. Today, China subsidizes Cuba's imports through trade credits, notably of solar panels. China also buys Cuban nickel, produced and refined by Sherritt International, a Canadian-owned joint venture. China has shown interest in building hotels catering to Chinese tourists and in building port facilities in Santiago and Havana. Can the U.S. and Cuba agree on a foreign investment regime that takes advantage of Chinese capital while screening out strategic threats? To ensure stability while the economic reforms take hold, the U.S. would have to accept the continuing political primacy of the Communist Party and the closely intertwined military for the next several years. Such an arrangement would resemble the model in Venezuela, where the Trump administration removed Nicolas Maduro in January, but accepts that the authoritarian Chavistas continue to government the country for the time being. If negotiations between Washington and Havana fail, the downside risks are great. The long-suffering Cuban people will face further immiserating hardships. They might rebel, demonstrating in the streets or attempting to cross the 90 miles separating them from the U.S. on makeshift rafts. Gutting images of bloodshed in Havana and drownings of desperate refugees at sea could prompt a U.S. military intervention, an outcome more radical Cuban exiles in Miami have long lusted for, but which previous U.S. presidents have shied away from since the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. Can pragmatic realism replace emotions and ideology on both sides of the Straits of Florida? Economists can delineate a path forward, but as we all know, it's politics that usually stands in the way. The U.S. oil industry doesn't want war either. It can't be coincidental, right? In the first 2 months of this year, U.S. President Donald Trump has attacked two of OPEC's 12 members, snatching Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January and killing Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei in February. Conspiracy theories and reasonable curiosity have converged on the question of how central oil has been to all of this. One senses that the average American thinks military action is now planned in a room with 10 oilmen, 10 Israelis, a shirtless Pete Hegseth, and Trump letting it rip. This misreads how strange it is for the U.S. oil business to find itself in war headlines again, with No Blood for Oil protest signs being dusted off. The international state of affairs undercuts one of the industry's biggest achievements this century, the shale revolution. Modern drilling and fracking techniques not only brought America close to self-sufficiency in energy, but also over time created an easier, more predictable way to do business. Other oil and gas producers were forced to make room for massively increased American oil and gas volumes. In the political realm, U.S. presidents no longer had to obsess over how an action would affect prices at the pump. In the grandest of American traditions, the rest of the energy world became non-player characters. At this moment, though, it's the U.S. oil companies that feel like NPCs, unsure what roles they're supposed to play in Venezuela, Iran, and other Trump-tossed countries in the Middle East. American shale producers have been clear in their message to the markets that they won't, and probably can't, chase short-term oil spikes with long-term capital spending to boost production in a meaningful way in the 106 million barrel per day global market. U.S. oil companies are also, for the most part, uncomfortable being interviewed as instruments of foreign policy. When Trump summoned oil executives to the White House hoping to secure commitments to help reverse a decades-long plunge in Venezuela's oil output, ExxonMobil Corp's chief executive officer, Darren Woods, disappointed him by declaring the country uninvestable. To understand why oil producers are not eager to leap back into Venezuela, or Iran, should it come to that, some historical context is needed. An oil company founder recently explained to me that oil is a 180-year-old story of frontiersmen and settlers. The job of the frontiersmen is to open up territory. The job of the settlers is to use technology to extract more oil and gas. Together, frontiersmen and settlers have kept prices remarkably stable and disproved predictions that the world was nearing peak oil production. Sometimes these two approaches reinforce each other, such as the deepwater offshore advances in the Gulf of Mexico and Brazil in the 1980s and 90s, which continue in other places today. In many areas, many eras, however, one or the other is dominant. The 1950s, for instance, were about frontiersmen opening up the Persian Gulf. In the past decade, the story has been all about settlers unlocking vast quantities of onshore U.S. oil and gas, and how this redefined the global energy market. In this period, the late shale revolution, the technological leaps of modern fracking and horizontal drilling morphed into a request for industry mastery to maximize efficiency in existing basins. This may sound a little bit dull, but settlers can plan for the long term. Settlers please shareholders. Settlers sleep well at night because they don't have to worry about unstable governments, corrupt officials, adversarial neighbors, and changing rules. For the old school frontiersmen still out there, those headaches are pretty much unavoidable, because most countries blessed with oil and gas resources are also cursed by them, with the exception of the irritatingly even-keeled Norwegians. In comparison, the U.S. political environment during the settler era has not altered the industry's fundamental trajectory. Yes, American energy policy has a bipartisan tendency to be hypocritical, incoherent, and unhelpfully aspirational. This might also be a good description of life. The Biden administration rolled out hundreds of billions of dollars of government support for renewables and electric vehicles to address climate change while being hostile to the oil and gas industry in ways big, revoking permits for the Keystone XL pipeline, and small, requiring companies to disclose climate risks in public filings. The Trump administration is fully allied with most in the oil business in wanting to own the libs, topple the windmills, and drill, baby, drill. But Trump's grumpy old man at the pump side, oil prices are always too high and someone is always to blame, manifested itself in Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's mercifully forgotten 333 plan. That called for additional daily production of 3 million barrels of oil equivalent, a measure that covers both oil and gas, by 2028. Yes, shouted the oil man, but also 3% annual economic growth through, among other things, actions to substantially decrease the oil price. Well, wait a second. As it turns out, whether the administration is supportive or obstructionist hasn't much mattered. U.S. production is not yet on track to grow by 3 million equivalent barrels per day under Trump II, but it grew by 4.3 million barrels per day in the Biden years. So this is where the oil business was before it became a spectator to recent events which are causing consumers to howl about gasoline prices, pundits blame oil companies, and your dentist to become an expert on the Strait of Hormuz. To the recent pronouncements that the oil business will never be the same, it's always a good bet that this too shall pass. We heard similar prognostications 4 years ago when oil and European gas prices spiked after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But then came 3 years of decelerating demand, plenty of oil and gas supply, and subdued prices. But there are ways in which 2026 could usher in a more decisive shift in the industry. A sustained stretch of higher prices or a scramble for new sources of supply to replace war-destroyed capacity would hasten the inevitable end of the U.S. settler era. For years, even when the world had abundant oil and gas, industry analysts have pondered whether the next big finds could come from to offset declining output from existing fields. The most obvious place to look is within countries not producing at full capacity because of sanctioned pariah governments and kleptocratic self-abuse. One of the least likely places is from onshore fields in the U.S. Production from densely drilled shale basins already supplying more than one-fifth of the world's oil and gas can't grow endlessly. The U.S. Energy Information Administration, part of the Department of Energy, last year forecast that U.S. oil output would peak in 2029 and gas production in 2032 before slowly fading on a gentle downslope. The U.S. oil industry is also consolidated to the point that it's not that much different from grocery store chains trying to grind out more profits on the back of incremental efficiency gains and fewer middle managers. It's not lost on investors that while about 44% of Exxon's production comes from the U.S., only 24% of its profits do. Trump's actions in Venezuela and Iran have many possible reasons, or no reasons at all, but it's also highly unlikely that one of them was to give U.S. oil companies a kick in the pants. And even if it was, there are many ways the administration could, and given its track record, likely will, undermine its own goals in opening up territory for the U.S. energy industry. You could hand projects to incompetent cronies. You could improvise a heavy-handed industrial policy that pushes U.S. oil companies to focus on, say, reviving Venezuelan heavy oil production, a non not uncomplicated undertaking, instead of what they're good at. Also, as the Biden administration learned the hard way, no energy policy is future-proof, meaning that the current NPCs, Venezuelans, Iranians, and yes, even the Democrats, could reverse what was done when they returned to power. An alternate scenario is that Trump's actions succeed in unlocking new Venezuelan or Iranian supply, putting competing barrels into a market without the demand to absorb it, driving down prices and crushing any U.S. producer with a high-cost business model. What is clear, though, is that sooner or later another frontiersman era will be upon us, with all its necessity of supply, potential for success, risk of bad investments, and certainly of moral compromise. This will likely produce new winners with skills different from those that succeeded in the shale revolution. Whenever it arrives, the U.S. oil industry may look back with nostalgia on the days when you could just drill wells, cut costs, and ignore the news. Texas oil heists are booming. The Martin County Sheriff's Office sits along Interstate 20 in West Texas, a stretch of dusty plains and sun-baked highways that could almost be the setting for a Mad Max movie. It's sparse. Oil wells outnumber people, but that doesn't mean it's quiet for Sheriff Randy Cozart. At least once a week, someone calls to say their oil field has been robbed. Trailers missing, copper wire yanked, and most of all, crude stolen. In total, some 500 barrels worth of oil goes missing in Martin County every week, Cozart estimates. At last year's average of $65 a barrel, it's an annual loss of roughly $1.7 million. At war-heightened prices, it would be far more. Similar scene is playing out in dozens of other counties across the Permian Basin of West Texas and New Mexico, the world's most prolific shale oil patch. Law enforcement officials, legislators, trade groups, and energy producers say people are stealing more crude than ever, often laundering it into local supply chains or driving it to Mexico to offload it. Where there's money, there's crime, says Cozart, who, like many in the region, once worked in the oil industry himself, and there's lots of money in oil right now. More than 40% of oil executives surveyed by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas this past fall said their operations had been affected by theft during the previous year. Several dozen petroleum product arrests are now made annually, up from perhaps a single arrest per year a decade ago. Texas Department of Public Safety records show. Some estimate annual oil theft in Texas at around $1 billion. Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, an industry advocacy group based in Austin, calculates it's more than double that, and the $2 billion figure doesn't cover thefts in the New Mexico portion of the Permian, a smaller but rapidly expanding corner of the basin. As the situation worsens, state lawmakers, regulators, and even the FBI have taken notice. The old joke in the oil field used to be that if it wasn't bolted down, it would be stolen, says Michael Lozano, who runs government affairs and communications for the Permian Basin Petroleum Association. Now they're unscrewing the bolts, and they're stealing those, too. Opportunistic equipment thefts have logged out oil fields, which are often located in remote areas and left unmanned for weeks on end. But in recent years, crude theft has become more sophisticated and frequent, according to producers, sheriffs, and local officials. Many perpetrators here are more brazen than those who stealthily tap pipelines, a tactic that's hurt producers in Mexico and Russia, although some pipeline tapping also happens in the U.S. Today's Permian Basin thieves might instead connect vacuum trucks to storage tanks in broad daylight and siphon out the oil, sometimes covering their license plates or swapping vehicles to evade law enforcement, authorities say. In one popular ploy, they pose as waste haulers, which companies hire to remove toxic water from the tanks, then make off with the crude. Skilled perpetrators can often hide in plain sight, syncing up their hits with an oil field's busiest hours. That way they can blend in with a parade of trucks that are authorized to pick up oil. We get oil probably every quarter mile, says Lieutenant Richard Dickinson, who works in the sheriff's office in Texas, Ector County. He said calls about industry theft come in almost daily, though he estimates that his department only solves about 2%. It's more than law enforcement or oil field security people can keep up with. Experts say there's no single reason why it's getting worse. For one, the Permian is pumping more oil and gas than ever before. Natural gas, another basin product, isn't a common theft target because, well, it's a gas. Over the past decade, the region more than tripled its oil output thanks to the expansion of fracking. The fracking boom has made a lot of people in the region very rich, but not everyone has gone along for the ride. Even those fortunate enough to collect a high oil industry salary aren't guaranteed work forever. Over the past decade, the U.S. oil and gas industry has lost roughly 40% of its jobs, due in part to efficiency gains like robots replacing humans on rigs. When jobs are hard to come by, oil field theft is a way to make a quick buck. From a cost-benefit analysis, the risk is low, said John Smietana, a senior lecturer in criminology and criminal justice at the University of Texas Permian Basin. To dispose of the stolen oil, thieves sometimes work with saltwater disposal facilities, which legally sell crude recovered from wastewater, to launder stolen barrels into local supply chains, law enforcement says. Some thieves might even buy a depleted oil lease and pretend they pumped the hijacked crude themselves. Smietana, who served in the U.S. Border Patrol before his career in academia, says the stolen oil is sometimes driven south of the border. Last summer, Texas enacted laws to better understand and deter the crime. The state also created a task force to study theft under the Railroad Commission of Texas, a body that regulates the energy sector. It's required to deliver a report with legislative recommendations by December. Part of the mandate is to determine exactly how much money oil theft is costing the region, says Jim Wright, chairman of the Railroad Commission. The cost is often borne by producers because missing barrels aren't typically covered by insurance, says Cole Harrison, owner of Fiesta Energy, LLC, which took a $15,000 loss last year when someone drained one of its tanks. It's hard to prove, he says. If a tank battery blew up or something like that, that's obviously much easier for them to see and quantify. The FBI, which formed a task force to field mostly equipment thefts in Permian oil fields in 2008, refocused its efforts on rising crude theft about 3 years ago, says Supervisory Special Agent Britton Goad, who coordinates the FBI team that also includes state and local partners. In 2023, the federal agency began collecting data on the phenomenon, finding numbers of barrels stolen was actually down in 2025 from the prior 2 years. Goad attributes that to progress through the growing counterpunch of focused law enforcement, regulators, and legislators. Lower average prices in 2025 compared with those in recent years probably also helped, something that hasn't continued into 2026. He concedes that the agency's data, which suggests the problem is much smaller than others say, has limitations. It relies on self-reporting and doesn't include many of the Permian's smaller operators. The ones that are actually impacted the most, Goad says. The data is only as good as the people putting it in, he adds. We don't always know what we don't know.